The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
We have made a good start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good evening, listeners. Welcome to our Tuesday evening Open Lines program. I am your host, David Livingston. Thank you for tuning in. And as I said, this is Open Lines, so all space and STEM topics are welcome. We certainly encourage first-time callers, would love to have first-time callers call us. And keep in mind that we'll talk about the topics that interest you, and those are the priorities. So call us about anything, but we prefer space and science and STEM-related topics. After all, this is a space show. So our toll-free number, for those of you who would like to participate with us tonight, is 1-866-687-7223. Email drspace@thespaceshow.com. And the blog for this show is on our website under upcoming shows. This is the first show listed. That is the archive page for the show. So click on it, open it, and then all the way down to the bottom is where you can post comments or ask a question. As soon as you do that, I should be able to get it, and I can integrate it into our program. So we do want to hear from you, and the telephone is always the preferred way. So again, the toll-free line is 1-866-687-7223. By the way, a couple of you have been sending me emails asking me about my pending move, which is starting this weekend. Yuck, yuck, yuck. The toll-free number from your perspective will not change, but the underlying number that it's connected to will change. I have to figure out how to do that with MCI. So hopefully by the time we resurrect the show and the studio is all connected, I will be able to have a new number for the toll-free line. But it won't change for you. You'll still be using 1-866-687-7223. A couple of other quick reminders. There's no Hotel Mars tomorrow. Mike Gold is a guest on Friday. And then we go dark for the move. And there won't be a Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday Hotel Mars show. I don't think there's a Friday show either. And then I think we're all set to come back on the following Sunday. If there's any change in our schedule, you'll see it on the website, okay, and on the website newsletter. So do go to our website, thespaceshow.com. So our detailed newsletter is there. It's uploaded fresh every Sunday. Remember, everything we do is archived. There's a store in the upper left menu under support if you're interested in Space Show paraphernalia. Listen Live is there. It tells you how to listen to live shows, archive shows, podcast shows, and Alexa shows. And then center right is Support the Space Show. So remember, we're a 501c3 nonprofit with OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. And if you donate to us, and we hope you do because we are a listener-supported online radio program, your gift is tax deductible, providing you pay U.S. federal taxes. And the same is true for those of you paying California taxes, as we're a public benefit corporation in California. Check us out at our nonprofit website, OneGiantLeapFoundation.org, or email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com with your questions. And we absolutely appreciate your support, and we thank you very much for it, those of you who have supported us and those of you who will be supporting us for the first time and again in 2018. We do have sponsorships for businesses or individuals that want something different than, say, a PayPal contribution. So if you become a sponsor of the Space Show, you do get your banner ad going across the Space Show website, and you can change that banner ad as often as you like. And I will also read your promo message on every full-length Space Show program, 60 seconds or less. On the shorter Space Show formatted programs, I acknowledge and identify our sponsors and thank them on air. So there's a lot of visibility for you, and that visibility goes for years and years and years, because shows that are even several years old still get played. So if you've got a sponsor message on those shows, people are going to hear it long after the initial date those words were spoken. So there are a few sponsorship spots left, and if you're interested, please email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. The sponsors for the first segment for tonight are the Space Foundation, given their 34th symposium is around the corner. It is, when is it, April 16th through the 19th in Colorado Springs. Check it out at spacesymposium.org. You need to go to at least one of these. I mean, I was really, really impressed when I went last year. I hope I can go this year. I'm not sure that I'll be able to, because my move was unexpected and has been an unexpected burden. So I'm not sure if I'll be able to take off in April. But anyway, I really recommend that you do at least one Space Foundation meeting. It's very different than an advocate meeting. Orbital ATK is a global sponsor and is a sponsor and a global leader in aerospace and defense technology. And they are known as the partner you can count on for advanced, reliable space propulsion systems for space exploration, commercial ventures, and defense programs. And we do have a caller who is on hold. Somebody called us really, really early in the show. I'm assuming they're still on hold. So if you are still on hold, caller, you need to sit tight. I have a couple of announcements, not too many tonight. But I see that SpaceX delayed on their Falcon Heavy static fire test. If anyone has any updated information on that, I'd appreciate your calling us and sharing it with us, and that would be cool. Another thing I noticed was a Mr. Gerald Black, I don't know him, posted a comment on the Space Review yesterday about our space program with NASA being overextended, and he thought we had to get rid of some of the programs in order to go back to the moon and do some other things. And he is recommending dumping, canceling, whatever you want to call it, SLS, Orion, and the Deep Space Gateway. Now, he doesn't give a reason for dumping those other than he says that that's pretty much his personal opinion of the priorities. And I sent the article around to a few people, but it's on the Space Review, and again, his name is Gerald Black. I am going to reach out to him and see if he'd like to come on the show and discuss his ideas in more detail. But if some of you have read his article or you want to go read it while we're doing the show tonight, that's cool. And you can tell us what you think. And if you think dumping SLS Orion and Deep Space Gateway makes sense and should be the way we go forward, okay? Another thing I wanted to tell you is that I don't have many in the way of announcements tonight, but the National Space Society sent out a notice saying March Storm 2018 registration is now open. Well, I'm going to read you some of it because this is what you're lobbying for if you participate in March Storm. Now, remember, you don't get to vote on this. You accept their agenda or you don't participate in it. So some of you may really like their agenda and others may say, that's not my agenda. I don't want to go. I want to lobby and push for something else. So let's talk about that. Here's what it says. National Space Society, the Alliance for Space Development, and the Space Frontier Foundation are sponsoring March Storm 2018, the premier citizen space-related Washington visit event. March Storm 2018 will be advancing the 2018 Alliance for Space Development objectives. 1. Establish an ultra-low-cost access to space, ULCATS, program based on public-private partnerships and streamed line governmental policy and regulations, and then you can click on their proposed draft bill. Number two, ensure a gapless transition from ISS to private space stations in LEO, with NASA assisting with development and serving as an early customer. Parentheses, see their draft bill. Number three, enable assist lunar development through a series of programs such as A, public-private partnerships to develop and demonstrate a reusable lander based in cislunar space. B, setting a price that NASA will pay for commodities, parentheses, water, etc., close parentheses, at locations in cislunar space. And C, purchasing data gathered by private companies on lunar resources, parentheses, water, comma, etc., close parentheses. This year, we have decided to request participants pay a $40 registration fee, and we are using Eventbrite, a popular and reliable service, to collect the fees. Please note, students are free on display of a student ID card during the training session. Also, if you are unable to pay the $40, scholarships are available. Eventbrite will walk you through the process. Please send any questions to Dale, D-A-L-E, dot Skran, S-K-R-A-N, at NSS.org. So that's March Storm. That's their agenda and what they're going to be lobbying for. So if you sign on to it, that's what your agenda will be, because you don't get to go out and do what's on your mind. You do what the collective wisdom of the head honchos thinks should be the policy. So if somebody wants to talk about that, or if you have a different idea of what March Storm should focus on, we want to hear from you. So our toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. Email drspace@thespaceshow.com, and let's see if our caller is still with us. Good evening, caller. Who are you and where are you? Thank you for calling.
Still breathing.
Still breathing.
Yeah. So this is David up in Seattle.
Okay.
And just wanted, I have a question for you in the audience, but a quick comment on the TuneIn player.
Okay.
I managed to install it on my Amazon Fire Stick, and I can play archive shows, but I haven't figured out how to get the live stream yet on it, if it's even available.
I think it's probably not available, so I'm not the one to ask, because technology and I don't always see eye to eye. But I believe it is a podcast format only, so it would require my having archived the show and turning the show into an MP3 and a podcast, and then putting it up on the GigaDial site, and then the podcasting sites that we use, plus, as I understand it, Alexa takes it from GigaDial, which is our podcasting client. So I'm not sure that it could be set up for the live show, but I think it's a podcast player, and there might be some Alexa users out there that have a lot more knowledge than me. I don't use it. I don't have Alexa. So I may not be giving you the best possible answer, but I can get a hold of Spencer, who is back in Vietnam at the moment, teaching his class over there. But I can find out. But I think Alexa is only podcast. I can also go to the customer service person who helped us put it up on the website and see what she tells me. And I'm making a note to do that in the morning.
So my question is, I listened to the show with Davide from Italy.
Okay, he's actually in the UK, but that...
Well, he's from Italy.
He's from Italy, right.
Yeah, on the archive. And I did have a question for him, and since, of course, it was the archive, it was too late. He made a comment that cargo should be a separate vehicle than manned crew. That was his preference.
Okay.
However, Elon is going in a different direction for the BFR and BFS. And I'm curious how he or the audience would analyze where Elon's going versus what David suggested.
Well, so first of all, if you post a comment, he will reply on the blog. So he will answer your question. Okay, but if you remember the vision for space exploration back in the day with Mike Griffin was a separate cargo and a separate human transportation, if you remember that. So they broke the two apart. Now, yeah, Elon, you know, is doing something differently. And Elon probably has a lot lower cost involved, or at least projected lower cost. But I can't tell you why he prefers doing what he said. I mean, there's a lot of other things he said that I certainly don't agree with. I mean, he also talked about how he supports the Jim Caraballo economic model, which is benefit sharing. And Jim went as far as to say that he didn't think a commercial space company that did not participate in benefit sharing and what he was talking about should even be allowed to participate in commercial space. So I don't know if you heard Jim's latest show, but Jim made some very bold statements about wealth sharing, moving away from scarcity economics and benefit sharing and things that a lot of new space, commercial space people don't appreciate. So, and David seemed to sign off on that. He spoke that he liked the Caraballo model, and he too talked about space should be for humanity and the global commons interest. So, but I can't tell you why he wants to separate cargo from humans. But if you post it on the blog, I'll make sure he sees it, and I'm sure he will respond to you.
Great. That's all I've got for tonight.
Question for you, please.
Sure.
This idea of benefit sharing and sort of wealth redistribution through space that Caraballo talks about, and new economics away from scarcity and economics, and what David supported. How do you feel about that?
Well, with no intention of insulting again, I think that happy, good times, plastic, banana, Euro socialism.
I was about to play Kumbaya for both Jim and David, but it's patented copyright music, so I was kind of afraid of getting busted for doing it. But
there must be a reason why the Europeans that are interested in commercial space tend to come over here to do it rather than do it in Europe. I mean, Europe has really an anti-entrepreneur, big government needs to do everything mindset.
Listen, I agree with you, but here's where I may part company with you. And I did say this, I don't know, did you hear the Jim Caraballo show?
I'm sure I did, but it doesn't...
It's about a month or so, 6 weeks ago. Okay, so one of the things that I agree with...
Oh, I remember that show. I had a really tough time making it.
So one of the things I do agree with Jim is that our economic system leaves a lot of people out. And the more disparity that happens and the more that happens, more than likely, the more unrest you have. And while I don't believe in benefit sharing and I don't believe in socialism and I don't believe in wealth redistribution, I do think that in the coming years, and whether that's 50 years from now or 100 years from now or 5 years from now, we're going to see some major restructuring of economic systems, not only in the United States, but around the world. And I hope that in the process of that happening, which I think will probably be pretty slow and will probably happen through mission creep of offensive regulations to a lot of people, but to loving regulations to others, I just hope they don't kill the golden goose. And they may very well kill the golden goose, and then where the hell are we? And trying to reverse all that stuff is going to be a lot harder to take it away than it is to, never put it in place in the first place. But I do think that at some point in the future, there is going to have to be something done to address some very serious global economic imbalances. And heck, we have imbalances in the United States that we just should not have. People that don't have food, that don't do this or that or the other. We throw money away at benefits that aren't worth a damn. We spend billions on education and our people aren't educated. They're down near the very last of the OECD countries in math, science, and verbal skills. And there really does need to be some wholesale changes. Just spending money on people and things and programs is not an answer. I don't have answers. I'm seeking answers from other people. I can see problems. I don't have answers, and it's very frustrating.
So a lot of smart people might say that global inequality and problems with countries that have been referred to recently as having to do with the S word it is often due to the unequal distribution of freedom and capitalism.
I 100% agree with you. Absolutely. There's no doubt in my mind that that is a huge part of what happens.
And I, too, am worried about us going down the path of ushering a new dark age due to over-government control and over-government regulation, of which, unfortunately, you guys in California are one of the leaders.
Well, yeah, and as the saying goes, and God help us if it's true, as goes California, so goes the rest of the nation. We don't even get to vote for minority parties anymore. I mean, under Jerry Brown's, you know, reform of the primary system, the two largest vote getters are the only ones on the primary. And because of the structure of the California Democratic Party and voters that probably should not be voting, but that's another story, you only have one party now on statewide and national elections. We only had one party for senator. We'll only have one party for governor. I've quit voting in California. I'll vote on tax issues and bond issues. Like, I'll vote to rescind the gas tax from Jerry Brown and those issues. But there's absolutely no point in voting for an individual until somehow this bill that Jerry Brown got in is reversed. And now they've done away with local polling places for voting effective January 1. And nobody in California saw that one coming. And
well, I live in the People's Republic of Washington, and we're tracking right with you. It's the exact same situation up here. And it is an indicator. You know, if you in California didn't have the engine of Silicon Valley,
we'd be worse off than we are.
It would be a hellhole right up there with Detroit.
But, you know, I have to tell you something, and this is why I have a foot in both parts of the world, because the listeners know I'm conservative. The fact that California has the genetically handicapped persons program for people with identified 7 or 8 genetic illnesses, of which cystic fibrosis is one, has absolutely kept my family and Michael, first of all, in very high-quality health care from Stanford and the University of California doctors, which have the best CF clinics probably in the country. But it has also kept us out of bankruptcy because GHPP picks up the copays that back in the day when we had real insurance, not the crazy stuff going on now, we'd have, you know, Blue Cross would pay 80% of what they think is reasonable, then they'd discount 10% and we'd be stuck with the balance. But a $200,000 hospital bill three times a year is still $60,000-$70,000 a copay. So GHPP picks that up, and Michael or my son pays a premium based on his tax structure. It's means tested, and they pay it at Medi-Cal rates, and the state institutions, the big hospitals like Stanford, things like that, accept GHPP, and they pay copays on some of his drugs that cost $10,000 a month. And so that is kind of socialism. The government is helping people out that have these genetic illnesses. And it has absolutely made Michael's life healthy. And he's 33 years old and doing really, really well. And GHPP plays a big part of his life today. And it has kept my family out of medical bankruptcy multiple times because of the expenses we've had in dealing with cystic fibrosis over the year. So I have a foot in both worlds here, and I understand the need for government in some capacity to help people, and a lot of people need help, and I was one of them. And before Michael was born, I would have never said that. I mean, I got my comeuppance right in the face. So this is one of the reasons why I don't have solutions to the problem, because I know there are two sides to it, two very good sides to it, and I don't know how to solve it or resolve it. And I have benefited, and my son has benefited, and I'm just thankful that California has had a really good GHPP program in place, and I hope it can continue. I don't know what to offer because, you know, as I said, I got a foot in both worlds here, and I'm a very confused person benefiting from both worlds, and I don't know how to resolve the problems. But I see them on the horizon for sure.
Well, to get back to space so you don't get in trouble with the
tax authority
in California.
Well, I'm being nonpartisan here. I mean, you know,
I firmly believe that without private space entrepreneurs, we wouldn't go anywhere.
But they're in California. You know, when I went to the Space Frontier Foundation meeting in San Francisco, I wish you'd come down to it. Well, it's going to be in Seattle next year, so hopefully you can attend it. And they did a panel for 3 days of entrepreneurs doing various kinds of space businesses. The only space business that really wasn't represented was human spaceflight, for obvious reasons. But they're all young, dynamic. Some of them were from India. A lot of women. They're doing various kinds of space startups and entrepreneurial businesses. They're getting tons of capital from angels and from venture capital companies. I couldn't have dreamed of this 5 years ago, and most of them are in California, despite the shortcomings that you and I both talk about. So it is a fertile ground for space development, for sure. Silicon Valley and South San Francisco down to San Jose is an unbelievable territory for creativity and business creation and entrepreneurship and technology, and I think there were more Californian businesses represented than all the other states combined.
So I have worked for a couple of Silicon Valley firms, although not in California. I always worked remote offices.
Yeah,
there's a tremendous amount of ability to raise money. There's entrepreneurship. It's a mecca for high-tech people that are succeeding in spite of the institutional hurdle created by the state of California.
And they don't want to leave. I talked to them after their presentation out in the hallway with, you know, coffee and muffin in hand. And have you ever thought about leaving? I wasn't interviewing him for the space show. I was just talking to him. You know, how can you stand paying all these taxes and things like the gas tax and all the stuff that Californians bitch about? They don't feel it because their advantages to their technology and their business are so overwhelming by being in California that these little other things are nothing but little hiccups on the horizon for them.
Exactly, but once they start getting into manufacturing and their business matures, where do they move to?
Well, they go to
Nevada, Texas, Florida.
You go to other places. I agree. I mean, unfortunately, X-Cor didn't make it, but they got out of Mojave for the most part and went to Austin, Texas. But other things happened, and the company didn't make it, but absolutely. But in their early stages, their creative stages, you know, their kind of rapid growth stage and all of that, California is the brainchild, and it's the inspiration place for all of this. So, you know, maybe they'll change. They don't seem to be too politically involved, which I find really interesting, to sort of change California and to vote differently and to do things differently to preserve the business advantages that they have. They don't seem to have a lot of dot connecting or connecting the dot capability to the people that get elected to the intrusions on their business. Again, that's because they're very, very successful, and so they don't feel the intrusions as much as someone who's more set in their ways might feel it.
And when they do get successful and hire professional managers, the managers like to go the crony capitalist route.
Absolutely. And then they still find ways to benefit by being here. But maybe things will change. You know, everything's a pendulum, and it's real far to the left right now. But maybe something will change. I don't know. I hope so.
You look at the mature tech companies like Hewlett Packard or Cisco. They've moved thousands, tens of thousands,
yeah,
maybe hundreds of thousands of people out of California.
And aerospace, I remember when I used to go to Sacramento to lobby with the California Space, I forget what it was called, California Space Academy, whatever, it went bankrupt. And we lobbied for space policy. And I remember one year we were going in Lockheed, and Boeing told us, their representatives told us, that their growth was locked in California, that they weren't going to take on any new business for California, and they weren't going to employ any more people in California, but they were going to keep their presence in California. So we would go into the senators and the assemblymen in Sacramento, and I was on the teams with several of these people, and they would make the presentation for this or that piece of legislation that was before the assembly or before the Senate, or to make an appeal as to what was happening to California's space industry, and it was all on deaf ears. They would tell these people that Lockheed is not going to grow their business in California. They're not going to hire anymore because of this offensive business climate, that they are going elsewhere, and they talk about Nevada and Colorado and here, there, and everywhere. Fell on deaf ears. I sat in the meetings for 3 years, and, you know, they're all polite, they're civil, and they pay lip service, but they're no more intention of paying attention to California aerospace industry back then than I could flap my wings and land on the moon. And so these companies, just exactly what you're saying, the mature ones, they voted with their policy and their feet.
Well, great. I've enjoyed the conversation.
Are you working in aerospace now?
Never was working in aerospace. Oh. I was the software guy.
Oh, software guy. So are you still doing that?
I was laid off a year ago, and I've been trying to decide, am I going to be semi-retired or fully retired or re-educate myself and go back to work.
Well, stay in touch with us. I've enjoyed talking to you very much.
I certainly will. Thank you, David. Hope to see you in Seattle or the Bay Area sometime.
Absolutely. Well, I'm moving to a little further North Bay to Petaluma, but still consider the Bay. So if you're driving down from Seattle, you go right through Petaluma. So
yes, I know where it is.
Talk to you soon. Thank you for your call.
Thank you.
Listeners, that was an unexpected call that went in an unexpected area. I enjoy hearing from David. The line is available, and it is ringing. Hold on, everybody. Welcome to Open Lines. Who are you, and thank you for calling. Where are you, please?
This is Marshall, out here in the great nothingness.
Now, come on, I'm an Okie, and it's not nothingness. Come on, it's a great state.
Oh, yeah, but one of my jokes is, why doesn't it rain in the panhandle?
Why?
It's so flat, the water doesn't know which way downhill is.
Marshall, that is why you're living in Oklahoma. We found out why.
Anyway, you asked about Falcon 9 Heavy.
Yes.
And it looks like it says static fire pushed back due to bug in launch pad hardware.
Are we talking about bed bugs or what?
I have no idea. I tried reading through the article, and it just said signs of bugs.
Eight-foot
threshold clamps, you know, just bugs. It's kind of like, well, that's really informative.
Bugs in launch pad hardware.
Yeah.
Okay, that's the first one. So I guess that's the clamps that hold it down when they fire off the 27 engines, right?
Well, let's face it. You fire off 27 engines, you better have some big straps holding that sucker down.
Just a couple of bungee cords, that'll work.
Anyway, you were talking about the fact that worldwide there's going to be a major change in economics.
No. You're reading words into my mouth. I'm saying that there are pressures mounting because of the global differences and problems with the lack of some kind of equality. But as David pointed out, the lack of equality is very likely to do with corrupt governments as it is to anything else. I just have a feeling that sometime in the future, and as I said, it could be 5 years, it could be 50 years, it could be 100 years, we might see an evolution toward some kind of different economic system that does try to equalize out or better balance the problems, because the more problems you have from this, the more difficulty you have in the world, the lack of stability you have, and the more problems you have. So I think at some point there is going to be an effort to modernize economic systems. Now, what that will look like and how that will play out and over what timeline, I probably will not live to see it, but I do think it would not surprise me if something like that did happen.
Okay. Here's what I want to inject and kind of let you think on. Right now, Intel makes the i7 chip design.
Right.
It runs at about 3 gigahertz.
I'm using it in my laptop that I'm using for the show tonight.
Right. And the new ones have 6 processors in them, and they're dual-threaded, so they can run 12 programs in parallel.
Okay.
And I was talking to my friend, Andy Pizzioli.
Okay.
He wrote the book on design verification, published by Springfield. And we were discussing, what is Intel going to do for the next generation processor? And we were talking, 4 threads, 8 processors, 32 parallel programs running at once, and probably 5 gigahertz. Any idea how much computing power you're talking about?
Well, more than was used for Apollo to go to the moon.
I'm sorry. One thread, one parallel processing unit would run circles around Apollo. I mean, that was basically nothing but a glorified calculator.
I was just kidding. But no, I do not know what kind of power, that other than it would be enormous.
Yeah. Well, the key thing is, when that kind of processor gets integrated into the world's economy, it's going to really change everything. Literally everything. Everybody is going to be able to talk to anybody at any time. It's going to be a totally different world.
So how is that, though, going to change an economic system built on scarcity, to use the terminology of Jim Caravalla, to something else?
Well, scarcity is basically where you are from, what is the logistical support system around you? Because, I can go to Amazon and I can just about buy anything I want, and it's delivered in 2 or 3 days.
Right, but we're talking economic systems you can't get all the money in the world. I mean, you can be very, very wealthy and don't need any more. Mm-hmm. But, it's a scarce commodity. Things like the metals, the precious metals, platinum, gold, they're a scarce commodity, and they have the value. In some nations, medical care is a scarce commodity. Food is a scarce commodity, and certainly bathrooms are modern plumbing, and certainly, all sorts of different, education is even a scarce commodity. So that's what Jim is talking about. The global economic system has so much scarcity in it at so many different levels that the people it can't even get into some kind of a balance. Now, David is right, the other David, that a lot of this is caused by really horrible governments, okay?
Yes.
And crooked governments and siphoning off, aid money and all sorts of different things.
Yeah.
And crappy education
systems.
Well,
with more computer power available, you can start tracking where that aid money's going.
Well,
you can also track where's the corruption. I mean, 80% of corruption is because nobody knows where to look.
So how does this make the how does this balance out and sort of even the world out without going to, say, wealth redistribution and benefit sharing, which was another one of the concepts that Jim proposed?
Yeah, well, the key thing is intelligent people are going to be able to get on the Internet and train themselves.
And now you sound like Barry Levin when he does those shows.
Let's face it. Every time I turn around, I'm having to retrain myself on all sorts of weird things.
Well, so. You're an exception, not the rule.
Oh, that's true. And when exceptional people get out there, find the facts, and they'll move to fix things. The only way you can have a tyrannical state like North Korea is there is no communication. There's only one person that gets to decide what gets communicated and what gets communicated, and it's gospel. Well, I'm sorry. I had thoughts of, gee, what would happen in North Korea if we set up a smartphone internet system to where everybody could talk to each other? Ooh, it'd crash in weeks. Now, the problem is, cell phone towers are kind of hard to defend. Oh, well. So.
So your solution is more computing power in the hands of more people.
It's coming. That's what I'm basically saying. It's going to happen.
It's a fact. It's not up for grabs.
Yeah. Well, let's face it. When you were in high school, you know, how big were the problems you could solve? Not very big. You know, it's pencil and paper.
Well, they're still not very big that I can solve. They're still localized.
Yeah, but by 1973, we had the ASC computer, and we were doing decent simulations and predicting what the world's weather was going to be like. And that's just the power of a 64 million instruction per second computer. So, I mean.
Well, again, you're an exception to the rule. You're not the normal person around the world.
Yeah, well, I'm hoping everybody kind of comes up to my level because I really don't think of myself being that smart.
Well, I don't know how you bring everybody up. Look at the level of our education in this country. Look at where we stand on math, science, verbal skills, and things in the OECD ratings. We're down near the bottom. And we're worse this year than we were last year. We dropped 6 points from last year.
Yeah, but on the other hand, Dr. Don Stice's comment was, you could take a million average people and you couldn't make a microprocessor, but you take basically 50 to 100 geniuses and we knock them out regular. So
when the world goes to hell in a handbag, you hope the geniuses are the ones that are left.
You and I should repopulate the world. Okay.
That's another story for another day, Marshall. Anything else that you see going on with space or that you want to share with us?
No.
I want to ask you. What's the Oklahoma mood, or do they even know about it or talk about it, regarding Bridenstine as a NASA administrator choice?
Where I'm at, the closest thing, well, I have two in-laws that are PhDs.
Okay.
Okay? But one of them is a PhD in education, so she taught at USC.
Okay.
And quote-unquote, very liberal, and nobody needs to go to space because there's nothing out there.
Okay.
The brother-in-law PhD is in economic modeling. It's called the SAS language, and calculating the fault rates on car payments and so on like that.
Okay.
You know, pretty tough math, and he doesn't have time for anything else. So it's kind of like I could talk to these people, but you know, they don't have any background. Nothing.
Well, do you see anything in the newspapers in Oklahoma about Bridenstine or anything like that? Does it come up in the news?
Well, I can go out to Real Clear Politics, and I can look there and see what the Washington, D.C. is.
No, go to the Tulsa World or the Daily Oklahoman. Do you see it there?
Well, in the Daily Oklahoman, I don't see anything.
And the Tulsa World, you don't see anything either?
Well, Tulsa World, I don't see it at all.
Okay.
So we don't get it here.
How far are you from Tulsa?
Tulsa?
Yeah.
It's about 100 miles.
Okay.
It's about 90 miles down to Oklahoma City.
Well, you can get it online. I mean, that's where I get it.
Yeah.
But I don't see them touting Bridenstine as a NASA administrator.
I don't see them having any alternative either. That's one of the key problems is having a good administrator is very important because the administrator has to work with Congress to push the different programs and, has to come in there and be the communication between Congress and the average person at NASA. And very important job, but very, very difficult to persuade people in both directions.
Okay, Marshall, I appreciate your call.
Yeah, well, it's been fun. Until next time.
Until next time. I look forward to talking to you all the time. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye. God, listeners, we're already halfway through the open line show with two calls. The line is available if somebody else wants to give us a call. It is 1-866-687-7223. And, boy, we've gone off in some directions I would have never, ever predicted for tonight. Let us hear from you. While I'm waiting to see if anybody else is going to give us a call, I think what I'm going to do is take our break because we are at the halfway point. So, we'll be back in about 2 minutes, everybody. Don't go anywhere. Wait, the phone's ringing. I'll take this call, and then we'll do the break. I don't want to make them sit there and hold. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you? Where are you? And thank you for calling.
Hi, this is Kim in Mexico.
Hi, Kim. What's up?
I want to talk about the concept of you and Marshall repopulating the world.
Don't talk to me about it. It's not something I'm even the least bit interested in. But Marshall may be interested in doing it. He's younger than me, so you should maybe I don't have his phone number anymore, but you should talk to Marshall directly. But and frankly, if the world were repopulated with my genes, I think the world would be a tragic place. Surely we can do better. What can I say?
I don't know. You have your good days there.
All my days are good, but I don't think of myself as the global father like Adam, for example.
No.
You know,
I guess not.
I don't think National Geographic is in 1,000 years going to trace all humans back to Marshall and me. And I'm not going to space, so I'm not going to be the father of a Martian colony or a lunar colony. First of all, I'm claustrophobic as hell, so I'd probably never make it beyond a day or so in low Earth orbit, depending on how big the spaceship was. And second, I don't want to leave Earth. I don't want to leave my kids. I don't want to leave my dog. I don't want to leave my creature comforts. I'm totally spoiled. So, if I could orbit Earth as a tourist and like do 3 or 4 orbits, and I could easily be comfortable in the damn spacecraft, then I'd probably be up for that. I don't want to go someplace and not return or live someplace in space.
Yeah, I don't know if that really works either, though, because, you know, you might be comfortable while you're actually floating around there, but, you know, the going up and the coming down, I don't think there's any way around that being uncomfortable.
No, I don't care. It's the claustrophobia that would get me. I'd probably get space sick. You know, when I was doing a lot of scuba diving and underwater photography, and back in the day, as they say, I was on a lot of boats all over the ocean, and there were times I got seasick, but, you know, it wasn't too bad. I did take medication, but I would imagine I would get motion sick going to space. When I was learning to fly airplanes, and my friends at the University of Arizona who were encouraging me to get a pilot's license and who had pilot's license would take me up and do chandelles and do figure eights and this and that and the other, all the stuff that I had to learn as a private pilot. And I would be sick as hell for 2 days with a splitting headache from what they put me through just in a Cessna. So, yeah, it would probably bother me. But they say it rights itself. And I guess you can take medication to sort of stabilize yourself. But I think it would be cramped and claustrophobia that would really get me. I can't even go in an MRI machine to get my damn foot and ankle MRI'd from my dog accident without being sedated and blindfolded. And my head isn't even in the damn machine. So talk about, and when they had to do spinal MRIs on me when I hurt my spine at a AIAA conference, and I actually was in the tube. I think I took 4 Valium pills to try to keep me calm for 45 minutes. I mean,
that's a lot.
Yeah, that was a lot. And then people drove me to and from the MRI thing, and they had a thermos of coffee waiting for me when I got out to try to knock some of it loose, but I think it stays with you for about 12 hours. So I'm not one to go in a tight-fitting spaceship like an Apollo spaceship. I probably wouldn't handle that very well. At least I know that about myself.
Well, it's interesting that you're fascinated so much by space then.
I
guess just about the whole theme that this show has taken, the future is out there, and one way or another, I think that's what you're trying to get at here.
Oh, yeah, and I think the benefits for the Kumbaya crowd, which I guess I'm part of, are enormous through commercialization of space, through what we learn scientifically, through all sorts of things. I'm one of these guys who thinks that the solutions to most everything in the world, including cancer, for example, the cure for cancer, it's out there. We just haven't discovered it yet. And I think going to space helps and expedites us to discover all of this wonderful stuff and to peel the layers back. So I don't think that there's anything where there's not really an answer to. We just haven't found the answer yet. And I think space helps us find those answers, even if the answer has nothing to do with space when we come upon it.
Yeah, actually, it's interesting because one of your callers, or maybe it was you, raised the subject of, I think it was Marshall, that some people who are very politically inclined and for some reason, particularly ones that consider themselves very liberal, have this idea that there's nothing in space, and it's a waste of money to go out there.
Yeah, it was Marshall's cousin who has a PhD in education. I guess she teaches someplace. Who said that?
Yeah, and it's interesting. Sigbart has a friend who was getting them all down that road. My collaborator in Norway, and he's a very young guy, and he was really listening carefully to that. I tried for a while to spar with him on that, because it's a very important matter to be able to discuss, because it comes up a lot, especially among the young. And, you know, it's not like humanity is meant to only have a very practical way of doing everything, and we just focus on our needs, and everybody works together, and we're all perfect and happy, and kumbaya. Humans need a field of activity where, one, they're just playing, and two, where their imagination can fly free. And the value of that is so high that it's appropriate that, you know, whatever fraction you want to name, I would call something like a tenth of your economy should be just working on that, because the breakthroughs come from there. The people who are really bright in your society, the people who really want to push the limits, they're attracted to that. And what they work on will have payoff for the society. And the rest of the society will be inspired by watching those people and will have a sense that progress is important and that thinking is important and abstractions are important, because you know, the payoff is down the road. You can't just keep your nose to the grindstone and expect that you're going to be happy. You won't. And society will not progress if we don't have that push outwards.
Yeah,
and space is perfect for that.
Yeah, I agree, but obviously not everybody does. I think we're programmed with different genetic makeup, and we have different priorities and think differently. Fortunately, a lot of the entrepreneurial creative forces that you're talking about are, at this time, in this era, focused on technology and space. So I think that's a real plus. Maybe 200 years ago, they were focused on something totally different. And so the person with the PhD in education that Marsha was talking about, you know, her experiences and her ideas are valid, but she obviously doesn't have the same drive that Elon Musk has or Bigelow or something. So I think the those of us that see space as being vitally important to our future, we should be really appreciative that we have the talents of people like Bigelow and Musk and Bezos and some of these others, even though they're pretty flamboyant from time to time, that are with us, because they're really key and fundamental, and they inspire other people, even with some of their silliness, like Branson, for example. You know, where that'll be in 100 years from now, I have no idea. Have you ever heard Bob Zubrin, for example, talk in person? I mean, Bob Zubrin...
In person, no.
He moves... I mean, you could really dislike Zubrin, but there is no doubt that when you are in a room and he is giving one of his lectures on why we should go to Mars or what it means in terms of freedom or this or that or the other, Bob is one of the most inspirational, driving speakers, and you can look around the room. I remember him speaking at ISDC meetings, and there were a lot of young people in the room. They're on the edge of their seats, captivated, and when Bob finishes speaking, there's a circle around him of these people wanting more of him. And
yeah.
How much of that lasts and stays with these people and drives them vis-a-vis their education or their careers or their space activities or whatever, I can't tell you. I have no idea. But Bob is a force to be reckoned with, and so is Elon Musk, although Bob is a much better speaker than Elon Musk. But I just think the industry is really fortunate to have these people leading and driving, even if we don't agree with their policies or their antics or, you know, whatever, we think they're full of it. I think these people are really important, and we're lucky that they came along when they did.
Well, I think the time was ripe.
Absolutely.
I think we'll look back on this in 20 years, and it'll all seem tremendously logical that, of course, these people appear at this time because conditions are right, and the slow progress in the decades before that was which is bound to happen because the technology wasn't really ready, and it's sort of amazing what we were able to do with such simple technology, but now it's here, and things are going to take off.
There's an old saying, and I don't remember the words for it, but usually leaders or catalysts or change agents don't show up until it's time for them to show up. And you know, if you try to analyze that, it'd be pretty hard to figure out what makes the time for them to show up, but that seems to be what happens. And I, am one who, even though I'm cynical and critical from time to time, I really think the benefits for being in space, spending money in space, developing space, having these policies, doing the science missions like Dawn and, you know, Cassini and stuff like that, New Horizons, and being able to put people in space, I think this is going to be such a benefit for humankind down the road that I'm almost ready to play Kumbaya for me.
Yeah, I've been wanting to inform your general audience that you have a favorite version of Kumbaya, and you've sent it out several times, and I don't really like it.
Oh, is that the one with the drums? I really like that version. Are you kidding?
Yeah, I know you do.
Here, I'll play it for the audience. Let's see if oh, crap. I don't have it downloaded. I just have URLs that I have to go play. Wait a minute. Let's see if I can do it real quick. I like it. It's kind of like African drums in the background. Is that the one you're talking about?
Yeah, that's the one.
It is copyrighted music. Let's see if it'll play.
Copyright has lost its teeth for things like this.
Okay. Yeah, this is it. Sing along, Kim.
No, I'm not.
And it's got really cool scenes in back of it, you know, the video that goes with it. It's got 2,191,000 views. So I'm not the only one who likes it.
That was a particularly easy song to sing.
But I've got other versions, too. I'm trying to see who to give credit to if it tells me who did it. This is the one sung by the Seekers. This isn't the one I wanted. I played the wrong version. I didn't want the one with the Seekers.
Yeah, the other one had that tree at sunset and the drums.
Yeah, I wanted to play the one with the drums. Let me see if it's this one. I like the Seekers, too, but the other one I like better. Maybe this is it.
So this is new territory. You're playing music in the background. That's great.
I got rid of all my CDs because, remember, half the time I'd play break music and all that crap. They wouldn't work, and they'd get stuck in jams. So Tom and I set it up to play the feeds and the direct things directly from the lap. Here it is.
From the sand of the great Sahara of the total planet.
This is the one I like.
Seven kitties to the shore of the cave, good old the spirit of Africa, beneath the way into the heart and mind of all.
You got it queued up a little better there, so it misses that lead in, but
that was my fault. So this one only has 30,843 views. It's not as popular. Okay, that's enough. And this one, I'll give credit to the group singing it, is the Happy Gospel Singers with Dagmar. I'm going to mess your name up, Dagmar. I really apologize for this. Dagmar Dibben or Dibern. Shoot, it looks like an Afrikaans name, S-C-H-U with the two little dots over at T-T. Dagmar Dibben Shoots, the Happy Gospel Singers. So so much for music for the space show.
Yeah.
You know, if they do the Falcon Heavy test and the static test and they show the video of it and it's got good audio, and the sound is really compelling, that may become an audio tape I play on the show, would be the rockets roaring.
Oh, for sure.
You know,
there's a ton of clips from their launches you can use.
Yeah, I'm waiting to hear what the 27 rocket engines sound like on that static test. So hopefully they will show the video and there will be decent audio of that sound. I would imagine it's going to be pretty loud.
I hadn't thought of that. Yeah, that would be very impressive. I mean, you know, even one rocket engine firing, you know, it's just overwhelming. So it's sort of a subtle thing to say, you know, 27 will be extra more awesome. I mean, it's eardrum breaking noise for any rocket launch.
Yeah, and that may become new space shuttle bumper music if it you know works and pulls off and it's good audio. So I'm looking forward to that. Anything else on this weird night for open lines? What else?
Yeah, actually, I have not talked about anything that I was planning to talk about when I originally thought about calling in.
Well, so now you need to talk about it.
Well, this, you know, if one thing, I wanted to point out this thing about the heavy. I've been following the progress of the launching of the Roadster.
Uh-huh.
And I want to point out, because, you know, I went to our college, so I can say this. This, I think, will count officially as the most expensive performance art piece of all time. It definitely qualifies. If, you know, Elon wasn't a billionaire, the MoMA would be interested in picking this up as a piece of modern art, of launching a car into space with a song on it. It's art.
I think so too, but the performance art will be, you know, flying around Mars. So, you know, it'll be in motion. It's not just the launch.
Oh yeah.
So I don't know.
Yeah, but all good performance art pieces are like that.
I don't know how MoMA would display this, because I don't think that you would be able to see anything through telescopes or anything. I don't know. Maybe you could show it tracking as a little blip.
Well, that when there's a performance art piece, usually what's done is that there's documentation while it's actually going on, and then the documentation is the exhibit afterwards. So that could definitely be done. I actually have been wondering how much they're working on the documentation of the car itself. They have been excellent with the cameras. In every single launch is better than the last. They have these amazing long range shots. They've got to have drones around the drone ships when it comes back in. I mean, flying drones, so they film them come down. They have this amazing set of camera work that they do.
Well,
so
yeah,
I'm hoping that they continue with that trend.
Yeah, but there's not going to be any camera work out there at Mars.
Well, no, it would be the stuff while it's still in range. But there could be some really amazing shots while it's still in range. I mean, I hope they have cameras on that car.
I'm sure that they probably will. I mean, he is into performance. There's no doubt about that.
Oh, there's no doubt about that. No.
But I agree. I think, you know, if it doesn't blow up all over the place like he keeps saying might happen, I think it'll be a monumental art thing, and I bet people pick up on it for art, for performance art too.
Yeah, I think that's exactly the thing. That's why I, you know, once I heard about the concept, I had no qualms at all about whether or not it should be done. It definitely should be done. It hits a whole new audience, and it gets the audience that's already into space on a different level. It's a brilliant move.
No, I agree. I really like it, and the fact that the Tesla is going to be red is even better. So
midnight cherry red.
Yeah,
yes, it's.
I can just see someone like in a Star Trek show 500 years from now, you know, here comes this strange payload. What is this? It looks like a car. I just think there ought to be a dummy or an android of Elon behind the steering wheel. So that would just be the best of all worlds, especially if it gets discovered hundreds of years from now.
Yeah, if it makes it probably will. I mean, it you know. It's one of these things that if it makes it, it'll live in infamy, you know, right up there with Voyager.
So I think Elon should have a mannequin of himself behind the wheel, and I hope he's got that as a little surprise for everybody. But we'll see. We'll see. I'd love to see that, you know, or one of a life-size cardboard cutout of him behind the wheel or something.
Yeah, something. There should be something in the car. I'm not quite sure what would be the really great thing to do with that.
They got to have a driver, and who better than Mr. Musk?
Well, I don't know. I mean, the whole thing's pretty playful. Like, I think it could do something a bit more provocative than that.
Well, when I was in high school, they used to see how many high school students could be crammed into a VW bus. So maybe what they do is cram in the SpaceX cardboard cutouts or the crew or something and put them inside, you know, mannequins mm-hmm. of everybody who worked on it. You know, maybe they do something like they used to do, and they used to cram people into phone booths to see how many people they could get in. I don't even mm-hmm. know, do they even have phone booths anymore? I don't know. But, yeah, I think it'd be, I'm hoping to learn more about maybe what's in the car and how he's going to promote it, but I think it's an absolutely brilliant move. I'm very supportive of it.
Yeah, actually, I realized today, or I wondered for the first time today, I guess because they're planning to do the static fire, I suppose because of the boosters and the way they're connected to the main booster, maybe they don't want to take that down again. Maybe it's in its final position, because if that's the case, then it's already up there.
Yeah, I'm sure it's already up there, but there may be surprises in there that he hasn't told us all about.
Sure. Yeah, they usually take the Falcon 9s down again after the static fire, don't they?
I think they may take them down after, but this hasn't had the static fire yet, and we don't know when the actual launch date of the Heavy will be. So I don't know, but he also does have surprises, like, you know, when he launched the cheese to space things. So he may have something inside the Tesla that is going to entertain us even more than the Tesla.
Yeah, could be.
Okay, anything else? Is that why you called?
No, actually, I had a list of things. I've been baking today. I'm doing the process of doing the final skinning of all the models in the initial colony for Moonwards. And so I've been catching up on my reading because my computer is completely occupied calculating these skins on these models. The one that's running right now won't be finished until about this time tomorrow. I'm going to leave it on overnight and all that. So I've been reading away, and so I've gotten my nose into a bunch of things. This is the way I would like things to be all the time, that I get to read about. I noticed for the first time, I haven't checked my space feed for ages because I just don't really have time. And Paul Spuda said an article today, and I didn't catch the initial thing that caused his distress about articles that had appeared in the last week or two. But there were articles about the discovery of lava tubes near the North Pole. And he called BS on that, or at least not BS. He said it was really quite inaccurate, and those tubes aren't what they're being represented as, and went through it very carefully. And I highly recommend it to anybody who's heard that news piece, because they're not lava tubes, and even if they were, there's not going to be any water in them.
You can pick that up at his website, by the way. I forget what it is, but it's Lunar or something.
Spoon of Lunar Resources. That's where you can comment on it. The article was in Air and Space, where he usually writes.
I'll put the link to it when I archive the show.
It's a very good analysis of the whole thing. One of the things I really liked about it is that the SETI press release that this whole thing came from looked at images from the LRO in one of the young craters that's Philolaos. It's close to the pole, but it's really like 300 miles from the pole. And what tickled me about that is the pictures that they're talking about, anybody can go look at them. They're all online. It's an absolutely wonderful service. You can go and zoom in to exactly the shots they're showing you and look at all this stuff yourself. So they analyzed it, having people with a training in geology and considered the structures. But there's nothing, anybody could have done this. In fact, this reminds me very, very much of me doing exactly the same thing with Lalande Crater, which is, has very similar structures. And so when I started reading this article, I knew exactly what he was talking about. These aren't lava tubes. It's a whole different thing.
Well,
so it's one of those things, you know, the world is changing in the sense that this is a press release from a major research institute, but anybody could have made this discovery. It's publicly available information, and anybody could have challenged it too.
I'll put the link to what Spoutis wrote on the show and let people see what we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
All right, I should make room to see if anybody else wants to call, unless you have something else.
Yeah. Oh, no, I do. I mean, I can call back if there's no more callers. It's been a good show. I had a feeling that Tuesday evenings might start working out well for this. I'm glad to see.
Very weird. Very weird program. all right. If it's slow and I haven't pulled the plug, then call back. Okay?
Sure.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye.
Listeners, we missed our break. So let me, while we're waiting to see if anybody wants to call back, let me thank the sponsors as if we took the break, okay? So AIAA is a sponsor, and we deeply appreciate their sponsorship. They are the world's largest aerospace and professional society. This is the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics. They have five different forums or conferences every year: SciTech, Defense Aviation, Propulsion and Energy, and then Space, which is usually the one that I attend. They also have an in-depth Forum 360 program, which is really good, very well attended. Technical programs, lots and lots of very good, high-quality networking. So you can get a lot more information about them at AIAA.org and attend their events. Celestis is also our sponsor, and they still are the only provider of Memorial Spaceflight Services in the world. Proven provider, I guess, and they are pleased to announce that they have five programs scheduled for 2018. Each Celestis Memorial Spaceflight brings together family members and friends from around the world to witness firsthand their uniquely compelling service. For 2018, they have the seventh Earthrise mission. It's called Starseeker Flight aboard an Up Aerospace Spaceloft XL rocket out of Spaceport America. That's scheduled for April of this year. Their seventh Earth orbital mission, the Heritage Flight from the Cape, and that will be part of the General Atomics OTB satellite. A Falcon Heavy is launching that. Their second lunar mission, Luna 2, is going in fourth quarter 2018 from New Zealand aboard the Electron by Rocket Lab. This is a Moon Express ride. And I have been talking about this for Celestis. This is a little bit of a news item. And we've been reporting it from previous spots that Celestis gave me as a first quarter 2018 launch. And now they're at fourth quarter 2018. I understand this is because of delays and things in testing the Electron rocket, but maybe someone out there follows this closer than me. If they're launching fourth quarter 2018 and this is the same Moon Express spacecraft, then what does this do for Google Lunar XPRIZE? Because I thought that it was extended one more time to March or April of 2018. And if we're talking fourth quarter, then Moon Express is not competing in the Google Lunar X Prize. So I'm a bit confused. If anybody out there has information on Moon Express, the Electron rocket, the launch date, and Google Lunar X Prize, please let us know. Celestis also has their eighth orbital mission, which is a Horizon flight, fourth quarter 2018 from Vandenberg. That's a Falcon 9. And then their first Voyager mission, which is called the Enterprise flight, and it'll be also fourth quarter. The fourth quarter is going to be busy. And they're going to announce the details in March of 2018 on that one. So the reservations are open, and go to Celestis, C-E-L-E-S-T-I-S, .com for more information. Remember, I am their customer, and I think very highly of the company, and if you use them for your memorial to your loved ones or to put your own DNA in space, I know you're going to be very, very happy that you did that. Looking to see if we have more callers, and we don't at the moment. It is 1-866-687-7223 if you want to give us a call. Interesting, the more callers we get, the less email we get. So I haven't gotten very many emails tonight from listeners. In fact, I'm not sure I've gotten any emails tonight from listeners. But we did get phone calls. Excuse me. There are some other things happening. Let's see if I can give it a couple more minutes before I decide to say good night, everybody. Good night. Well, I forget what that is. I'm looking for my news clip file for open lines. So here we go. There was an article. Let me tell you which you might want to read. It's in CheatSheet.com. I mean, that's the name of the website. It's called Culture Cheat Sheet. CheatSheet.com. It is by someone named Ryan Davis. I do not know who Ryan Davis is. And it says, Mars attacks, exclamation point. Life on the red planet would be horrific. Here's how. And then this person, Ryan Davis, goes through detailing how absolutely horrific it would be to live on Mars. So if you want to see the article, go to CheatSheet.com, and Life on the Red Planet Would Be Horrific is the headline. And if you read it, let me know what you think. Listeners, we have another caller with us. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you and where are you?
Oh, this is John Fort Worth.
How are you, John, in Fort Worth?
I guess I'm okay.
Okay. Good for you.
Yeah.
What's on your mind?
I don't know. It's clear to me that I wonder if, since they've managed to land the Falcon 9 first stages the way they have, could we modify the SLS first stage to land it the same way, basically?
You're asking the wrong person.
Well, this seems like an interesting idea that should be considered. I mean, it looks like the SpaceX has proven a concept on how to do it, and you could certainly get a lot more bang for the buck out of your SLS first stages if you didn't throw them away and reuse them.
Well, but I don't think it was built to be reused, so...
But was the Falcon 9 really originally? I mean, originally it was supposed to be landed with a parachute, I think, but failed tremendously bad, as I recall.
No, they built it. They always said they built it for reusability from day one, and also for humans from day one. Now,
but they also were going to do it with a parachute.
Well,
that broke up. The landing leg thing was a later evolution, I believe.
I don't think that, of course, SLS is a lot heavier and bigger. I don't know. I doubt that they could modify it to do that.
See, well, I don't know.
I mean, right now they can't even fly it, so.
Well, it hasn't completed yet. I mean, obviously it's been underfunded, and like any underfunded program, it takes forever. I mean,
I don't know. I doubt that's something that they're even interested about, and then it still has so few missions to fly. What would be the point of reusing it?
Well, fly more missions. If one of the reasons there's so few missions is they're expensive, and therefore you can't afford to build very many. Therefore, you.
I don't know. I mean, the engines, everything would have to be. I doubt that they could retool it to make it the first stage.
Weren't they supposed to use sort of shuttle engines anyhow, which are reusable? I mean, that's...
The SMEs, yeah.
So that strikes me like this was... It's just something at the time they took off, they didn't even... Nobody really... I don't know how seriously most people other than Elon Musk and company thought that was feasible.
Why?
You know, but since it's proven it, I think, whoa, that's, you know, you've hit on something and you get a good idea, copy it, you know?
why don't you go to the SLS webpage for the company and find out who the contact is and send them an email and then tell us what they tell you?
See what they might say about it. That's an idea. See who. Okay.
Yeah, well, they have a website, and they'll tell you who the leader of the project is and probably give you an email address.
So it's time to do this, right?
Yeah, so I'd ask them a short question, tell them this came up on the space show, and you would like to know if this is plausible, is it something that could be done in the future, or is it just not doable and why with SLS, and you'd really appreciate their letting you know.
Yeah, that's an idea. See if we get everything back. Okay.
Here, I think you got a reply from somebody who may know something about this. Sure, John, just dump another. This is David Noodleman, okay? Sure, John. Sure, John, just dump another $20 billion down that. The word and operative of the day is S-hole. So that's what he says. Sure, John, just dump another $20 billion down that S-hole.
Really?
Yeah. Well, that's what he means, because he didn't spell it out. He's sparing my sensitive ears and my cultural high level of decency, the profanity of others.
I mean, for such a absolutely vulgar phrase, I mean, it's probably something middle school girls would say, you know. It's ridiculous, and everybody's gone nuts about it, but anyhow.
Well, if middle school girls are saying it, they're not the president of the United States.
Oh, these people say all kind of stuff. Remember Nixon? Good grief.
Well, I'm listen, it's different worlds, so I don't know, just listen to... Anyway, I don't go down
Johnson,
there. I mean, you know, there are so many agendas at work here that it's not even funny. And
anyway, I just thought that was interesting. Well, I know there's a lot of hostility toward the SLS, but on the other hand, I think it does fit the model of a good moon rocket better than anything else out there.
Did you read that Space Review article that I commented on when the show first started by Gerald Black? I'm going to try to get Gerald on the show. I don't know him, but I hope he'll come on the show.
I've kind of glanced at it.
Then he says
article with a lot of details. I didn't really.
He is of the opinion that they're doing way too much and they got to narrow the field down. And so from his perspective, you got to dump. And boy, our friend Vijay will go orgasmic over this, because he wants to dump the Deep Space Gateway, and of course, I think BJ's on a mission to dump the Deep Space Gateway, given all the commentary he's been giving us for the past month or two. But also, he wants to dump SLS and Orion too, and think.
Well, I don't
want
to do that. I want to build a lander to go with them.
I know you don't want to do that. You're SLS John.
We've spent all the money. Let's get the payoff. I mean, let's do it.
You're SLS John. Of course, you're not going to want to dump the
SLS. Well, don't get me wrong. I'm in this because I don't want to waste everything we've already done. I mean, these other rockets are just not suitable to do the mission. They're suitable to do other missions, but not that mission. I mean, that's the point. And we need to complete the SLS and the full version, not the half intermediate version. That's my position.
By the way, did you see the safety article that I sent out to a handful of my friends that I usually send the dribble to? And of course, the space cadets are dismissing NASA's safety evaluation, but there are very serious concerns.
Hold on, that's earlier. Yeah, I saw that.
That
okay.
was earlier this week.
About the commercial
they're not going to meet safety standards. Here, I'll find the article and tell people what it is. And you know, I sent it to a bunch of people, and the bona fide blue blood space cadets dismiss it. And maybe I won't be able to find it real quickly. Damn it! Do you remember who it was?
Who said it?
Yeah, it was an article.
Well, Well, here it is. Futurism, what?
Yeah, that's it. What, tell us what it is or what the headline is.
NASA safety panel raises concerns over SpaceX and Boeing spacecraft.
Yeah, so people, you can find it by searching for that.
Chelsea Gould, I guess.
Yeah, NASA safety panel. What's the rest of the headline?
Raises concerns over SpaceX and Boeing spacecraft.
Okay. I would urge you all to, y'all, Marshall will appreciate that language, y'all, that's my Tulsa coming back to me, read it, because you will either jump up and down and cheer and say, yeah, finally somebody's telling the truth here, or you'll dismiss it, and you'll say it's more NASA dribble, which is what Bob Zimmerman did when I sent it to Bob.
I would tend to make a middle-of-the-road thing. It's something that's interesting. Isn't SpaceX just going to man up and get one of their own people to fly the thing just to show us?
I don't know. I think that was a while ago. Your newfound BFF, David Noodleman, has another comment for you, John, about
SLS.
That? Well, I'm just going to read it. Ask John what his take is on whose fault for Zuma, Northrop Grumman, or SpaceX.
I'd say probably I'm kind of split between Northrop Grumman and it's really a classified disinformation effort to make people think that the satellite isn't functional while it really is. How about that?
So you think it's actually functional and that this is all
I think it's a possibility. If the SpaceX rocket successfully got up there, then the only thing that could have really gone wrong is the separation process, right? And that sounds like the lowest tech part of the mission. It could happen, obviously.
Well, it had a special fairing on it, so that could very well have happened.
But then the fairing separate late, but it did separate. And it did make orbit, allegedly, according to SpaceX. So either it just didn't separate and we've got a satellite attached to a booster up there, or it did separate. I'm saying it would be, if it's a classified program, this is hypothetically, one type of idea along that line I've heard about is the idea to have a kind of a stealth satellite in the sense that obviously you can see it's up there, but if everybody thought it was not functioning and it just went dark, so to speak, and hibernation, then everybody writes it off as a non-event, then a few years later, when they need it for something, when, say, China blew up the one that we're counting on, they just send a signal and it activates.
I don't know, but...
By the way, I don't know anything to anybody in security world, so if I'm wrong, I'm just totally speculating here, folks.
Well, so, Mr.
I'd say that, or it just failed, but probably that'd be the Northrop Grumman device that was supposed to affect the separation, because I think either that or SpaceX is just trying to defend themselves. Well, I think SpaceX has had a pretty good record. It certainly didn't blow up, as the earliest report said, right?
Right.
I mean, that didn't happen, so they think they don't need to. I guess I would tend to think Northrop Grumman.
All right.
It's a deliberate disinformation to protect the mission.
David, if you have a different opinion, tell us what you think. SpaceX,
yeah.
Northrop Grumman, or a black ops project? Now, there was another article.
I like that one. You pretend it failed, but it really didn't.
Now, there was another article I was going to throw out on Open Lines, and even though we're probably coming up toward near the end of the show, I'll throw it out, and if anybody wants to talk about this, hey, this is totally, totally cool. Now, all of you know, if you've listened to the show for any length of time, that I am an absolutely unequivocal dog lover, and I can't imagine a space settlement, even though I probably would never go to one, without taking our pets with them. I mean, I really love being with my dog and pets. I'm crazy about dogs, okay? And there is an article that appeared in something called Mach, M-A-C-H, and Mach Technology, and it was on NBC News, mock.com, mock.science, da-da-da-da-da, and it says, dogs can't, this is made for me, everybody, dogs can't speak human. Here's the tech that can change that. A pet translator could be available in less than a decade so that you can actually talk with your dog. What if your pet dog or cat could talk instead of barking or meowing? You'd know just how much Rover loves you and maybe how sorry Fluffy is about the mess on the carpet. Well, we all know that's not about to happen, but recent, you're going to love this, recent advances in artificial intelligence. Barry Levin, are you listening? And all of you who have been posting on the blog as if you're total experts on artificial intelligence. But due to recent advances in AI and machine learning, all of you bloggers out there, pay attention here, suggest the long-standing dream of being able to converse with animals in a limited fashion could become a reality. Kim, you'll be able to talk with your dogs, too, in Spanish. With the help of AI, scientists are learning how to translate animals' vocalizations and face expressions into something we can understand. Recent advances include an AI system that listens in on marmoset monkeys to parse the dozen calls they use to communicate with each other, and one that reads sheep's faces to determine whether the animal is in pain. Taking note of the research, an Amazon-sponsored report on future trends released last summer predicted that in 10 years, we'll have a translator for pets. Dr. Khan Slobodatchikov, a professor emeritus of biology at Northern Arizona University, that's in Flagstaff, and author of Chasing Dr. Doolittle, Learning the Language of Animals, is on the vanguard of animal communication. More than 30 years studying prairie dogs have convinced him that these North American rodents have a sophisticated form of verbal communication. The prairie dog makes high pitch. Anyway, the article goes on, and it talks about how they truly intend to use a translator, like the universal translator in Star Trek, to talk to your dog. Being able to communicate with animals would mean more than just forging closer emotional ties. It could eliminate the guesswork in caring for them and saving their lives. 3 million unwanted cats and dogs are euthanized each year in many cases because of their poorly understood behavioral problems. But, you know, and it just goes on and tells you the application for this. And so this is real stuff. Whether it ever happens, I can't tell you, but I certainly would love to hold a translator up to Pepper and know exactly what she says. But in 10 years, Pepper will be 14, and none of my huskies have made it past 12. So these guys, you're going to come too late for my beloved doggies, and I'll be older, and I may not be able to have a dog when I get older, depending on lots of things. So you got to hurry up. This is my last chance to have a translator for Pepper and me to speak to each other. I love this article. Again, the headline is Dogs Can't Speak Human. Here's the tech that could change that. A pet translator could be available in less than a decade, and it's by Mock, whatever that is. I think it's NBC because it's got the peacock next to the word Mock. And it's on NBCnews.com. So I'll put the link to the pet article as well on the in the summary if anyone's interested, or this may just be something like me. But so now you could get informed consent. Fido, do you want to go live on a Mars settlement, or do you want to stay here on Earth? And, you know, depending upon the vocabulary Fido has, you might get a mouthful. I don't know.
Well, I'm still trying to wrap my head around trying to translate the dog language into human language. I mean, is there that much range in it, really? I mean,
I don't know. They're using.
I think in terms of their thoughts. I mean,
it's done with AI.
They're very conscious beings, and they have a lot of feelings and thoughts. But I don't know that it's a verbal language. I mean, imagine a human being that never had somehow been taught language. It would still be a sentient being. It would want things. It would want food. It would want affection. It would want to be not harmed. It won a lot of things, right? It won in, out. But that turns into a language you could actually vocalize in say, a human language, English, for example, or Spanish, whatever. That's where I think it'd be kind of hard to do. You know what I mean?
Well, they plan on doing it with AI and robotics. So if there
was
someone...
Wants out, for instance, well, you have to walk here is where you live.
Okay.
I mean, like, if I was in the country... You could tell the dog wanted out. It would go up the door and scratch on the door, for example.
I'm going to see if Dr. Slava Gadadachikov would come on the space show.
Yeah.
That'd
be a nice guess. I'm interested to hear about what is the explanation.
I mean, it's a little off the topic unless I say, do you think we could get the dog to consent to going to live on a lunar or Martian settlement? Okay, so here's a picture of the guy. He's got a sort of a Van Dyke beard and mustache. He's bald-headed. His name is Konstantin Khan Slobodadokachek. I can't pronounce it. He's an animal behaviorist and conservation biologist. He is a professor at Northern Arizona, which is Flagstaff, and he does his studies with prairie dogs. So they're rodents, so they're not really...
they have a developed society and defense system.
Yeah. So he was born in Shanghai. That's China, for those of you that were born in Paducah. And he's graduated from Berkeley. That may explain his weird field of research. But hey, I'm going for it, guys.
Well, good luck. I think it's hard to establish this communication in the sense that it would be turned into.
Here, listen
language.
To this.
I mean,
listen to this from his website. Khan is an expert in animal language. His book, Chasing Dr. Doolittle, Learning the Language of Animals by St. Martin's Press, showed that a number of animals have language and can talk. It is just that we don't listen. Yeah, blame it on us humans, okay? Khan's goal is to help people to listen to animals and understanding the animal. I'm getting him on the show. His website.
Well, go for it.
His website is... Let me spell this. Conslob as in boy, O-D as in David, chikoff.com, and he's at Northern Arizona State in Flagstaff. And how cool. He's a director of the Animal Language Institute, president and CEO of Animal Communication, short bio, long bio, blogs, dog behavior. Oh, my God, they got a dog behavior blog. Are dogs good for your health? Well, I already know the answer to that. I don't care what he says. Dog behavior problem, what, why, and when, how to solve them. They probably have to solve the human behavior problem, I would imagine. Canine fitness, health benefit of dog exercise. Cool. I'm going to try my best to get the guy on the show. So this will be a lot of fun for me, and I hope I have an audience that listens to it if he comes on the show. I know not everybody's a dog nut and gets into talking about pets and dogs and stuff like I do on the show, but it's a nice little digression, right?
No, it would be fine. I just say, I mean, my experience with dogs, such as they are, I just say it's difficult to create what he's talking about. I mean, you can kind of, if you knew everything about the dog and you're watching it and listen to it and everything else, I think you could understand what it was wanting. But I don't know that easily translates into something that you hear it's barking or something and that puts out something in English. You know what I mean?
I don't know. It depends on what the pet translator does.
Now, the prairie dogs, I don't know. Maybe they have some code words or something like, there's a crazy nut over there with a gun. Let's jump in the hole before he gets shot. Or, you know what I mean?
So your new BFF, Mr. Noodleman, says, I don't need a pet translator. My corgi would constantly say, give me more treats. Okay, well, you may be surprised, David. He may be wanting to... talk philosophy with you, so who knows? Now, Marshall Martin...
We'll try to sell you on the SLS.
Marshall has a little chiming in here, too. If a dog lives for 12 years, how much dog food will you need to launch it into space at $2,000 a pound? How much does a dog cost in space? Great Dane to micro dog. You know, Marshall, go stick it. We don't need your dismissive, negative, put down, prejudicial attitude here. We understand that you don't have a thing for dogs, and that's why you're so strange when you call the space show. We've got it figured now. I can tell you what 50 pounds of dog food costs from Costco, which lasts me about 4 months. So it's cost me about $40. So if I don't know what 12 years would cost.
12 years of dog.
12 times 40 times times 12.
Maybe you could have a robotic dog up there.
Well, maybe you could 3D print the dog food, Marshall, and it wouldn't cost anything. So there.
Well,
maybe we could 3D print the dog and it wouldn't have to eat.
remember on the original Battlestar Galactica, they had that robotic dog, you know, that for the kid.
John, I got to see if anybody else wants to call. We're so far off the path with space. It's not even funny, but I'm glad some people have responded. But, you know, Marshall, I've never thought of the cost of having the dog up in space, but what would the cost be of having a human up there if you couldn't produce your food locally? So according to Barry, you know, you could grow food hydroponically on Mars, and I guess others, you know, can do the same thing. So there might be ways to minimize the cost of food for humans. And if you could minimize the cost of food for humans, you could minimize the cost of food for your feedstock or for your pets, if you were bringing any feedstock with you, for example. So I don't know. Your BFF, again, Mr. Noodleman, says, if it's a Russian spacecraft, you only need about a day's worth of food for the dog. Oh, David, come on. That's cruel and unusual punishment. No dogs allowed on Russian spacecraft. They have a bad track record.
Yeah.
My dog's only going on the best, so I can't even put my dog on Virgin. So what can I say? Virgin Galactic doesn't have a great track record yet either. So
anyway, you don't think the SpaceX is just going to go ahead and launch their own test pilot astronaut?
I have no idea. I think
for their own budget, just to show, hey, we can do it and it works.
I don't know. Do they need any kind of a launch license or anything to do that? I don't know the answer to that.
But that would be a different chinning bar than getting it through NASA to approve one of their people to fly. I mean, you know.
I don't know if they could just do that and get a launch license or not. I don't know if there are some kind of provisions or rules for safety that would be there. And think of the liability waivers everybody, including the astronaut's family, would have to sign off on. I don't know if that's feasible or not. I don't think they'd have any problem finding people to do it. I don't think that would be the issue. I think the issue might be regulatory or PR or insurance.
Yeah.
Okay, I have one more email to read, and then you got to get off the line and see if somebody else wants to call. So Marshall says, great fun. Thank you, Marshall. And is this for the show or is this for something else? This is from Kim. Uploads discuss. I don't know what this is, Kim. You sent something from the blog. Kim posted something from the blog, and I guess I have to click on it to see what it is. Maybe it's a picture of her dog. Donning, it is a picture. It's a cartoon. Donning his new canine decoder, Professor Schwartzman becomes the first human being on Earth to hear what barking dogs are actually saying. Hey, 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 hey. So I guess that's what barking dogs are actually saying, is hey, 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 hey. Okay, it's on the blog. Anybody wants to go look at her cartoon, it's up there.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'll get off and let somebody else come in if they want.
Thank you, John. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
Strange night. So, listeners, I'm going to stop us at 2 hours. So that means if somebody else wants to get in, a call, you got 11 minutes to do so. And the toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. Just think, if we had the pet translator, Pepper could call Open Lines and tell us what she thinks of all of this stuff and if she's a space cadet or not. So, but we don't have that yet. So I got to get this guy to invent his pet translator and hurry it up. So we'll see if anybody else wants to call. The line is available, or send us some email. 1-866-687-7223. The next open line show is set for, I think it's Sunday, February 18th. I just booked Jim Muncy for returning. He's going to be on the show on February 11th. We have another caller. Yeah, this is a really interesting, active open lines night. Good evening, caller. Who are you? Where are you? Thank you for calling. Hello.
Hi, this is Kim calling back.
Yes. Are you going to put your dogs on the phone?
No, they're having fun outside. Their most favorite time is after dark when the mice and the rats come out.
Oh, it's disgusting. So what is on your mind now? Did the pet translator arouse you or something and make you think of something else?
Well, that is a Far Side cartoon that I posted there. One of my most favorite cartoonists of all time. I always enjoyed that.
So do you think if I get this dog guy on the show, it would be a fun show to do?
Well, you know, I think it's a serious stretch to try and connect it to space, and I'm not entirely sure exactly how much you can go off theme. I mean, honestly, I don't know if you should broaden the theme a little bit, or if it just doesn't matter if you have something that's a bit fun for everyone.
Oh, I just do it because it's interesting and fascinating to me. I go off the reservation pretty boldly once or twice a year. But yeah, I could connect it to space. I mean, I could say, you know, if you're doing work with prairie dogs, do you have to get any kind of informed consent or go through any kind of animal protocol to do research? And if we wanted to take animals to space and such a space translator was available, would it be sophisticated enough to where you could explain to the animal what you want the animal to consent to? And he'd probably say no, it wouldn't be that sophisticated. At least that's what I would imagine. But how sophisticated then is the animal language or the animal brain? I don't know. We talk about dogs and pets going to space quite a bit. And, you know, I've told my dog stories, and other people have told dog stories. Even my deep regret story that I sort of regretted telling on air, I got a lot of supportive emails and even a few blog posts that supported me for telling that story. I'm glad, I guess, I didn't take it out of the show. I mean, edit it out of the archive. So yeah, I would put him on just because I think it's pretty fascinating.
Yeah, it would be interesting.
If he's a good speaker.
Sure.
I mean, maybe the guy's a jerk, I don't know. But I probably won't be able to contact him until after my move is over with. But I'd be interested in following that up with the guy.
Well, I wanted to chime in with what you're talking about with Suma, because, of course, you know, I don't know how many people immediately thought, well, maybe they're just saying that it's lost because it's a secret satellite and they're trying to throw people off. But I've been amazed at the almost complete silence on that aspect of it in the mainstream press. They haven't even mentioned it. But it's, of course, the first thing I thought. And on space.stackexchange, we've talked about it. I asked a question about it, and one of our moderators, who is in the business and knows a fair bit about this kind of thing, was talking about there's a whole group of people, of amateur satellite spotters, who specifically specialize in surveillance satellites and secret satellites. And if people want to find out if they've spotted it, I'll put the link in the blog. And they haven't spotted it yet, and there has been a lot of chatter about it, but our moderator was calculating from when it launched, the ability to observe it from the ground for an amateur astronomer was not very good for the first week. And it'll be easier after that. And it's already, we'll already have drifted about 10 degrees due to precession. And because the exact altitude isn't clear, the plane is known. But he laid out what you would need to know and where you need to look if you want to try and find it. And there's certainly people out there who are trying to find it. And there certainly is precedent for the United States launching a satellite before that they had a technique for hiding from the ground. You can't do very much about that. We have a question about that, too. But you can do it to a certain degree. So it's, if you don't really know where you're looking, it's kind of hard to spot. And they've done that before, and I to me it just seems like a kind of a shrug, and well, you know, it seems pretty likely to me that they've done that again.
Put the link on the blog so people can look at it. It would not surprise me, but my hunch is that it didn't work.
Yeah, certainly that's also possible. SpaceX has certainly stood by its guns, so that just leaves Northrop and. You know,
they say you need to talk to Northrop about it. Our rocket worked fine. You need to go talk to Northrop about it. That's typically what they're saying, right?
Yeah, they say everything performed nominally.
Yeah, so. And it's their satellite, so you need to go talk to them about it. So I'm sure SpaceX knows, but they probably have the classification for secrecy for the launch. So they're not going to say anything. You're not.
There was a picture taken of the fuel dump. And so that was that they have that pinned down where that happened, which allows a certain amount of extrapolation. And that fuel dump was much higher than it was estimated that the satellite was going to be released. So it does seem that there was a certain amount of misdirection, at least. Which, you know, seems to suggest that there's some hanky-panky going on.
Don't know, but it would not surprise me if they were hiding it, and it would not surprise me if it was lost. So,
yeah.
And we may, sure. And the truth is we may never really know.
Nope.
So, and with that, what else?
Well, I'll sign off. I wanted to get that last little bit in.
All right. Well, I'm probably going to sign off too. So, thank you for calling. And
my pleasure.
I will talk to you later. So, okay. Have a good one. Bye bye.
Cheers.
So, listeners, Kim is off the line, and. If anybody really hurries and wants to get a call in, you still got a couple of minutes. 1-866-687-7223 is the toll-free number. So I remember when the satellite was lost at Mars, and NASA was saying that they failed to, and many of you will remember this story too, that they failed to convert the metrics to inches or vice versa. And people didn't believe that it was lost, and they thought it went dark and was a clandestine satellite, and they looked and looked and looked for it, and they could never find it. And then, with one of the subsequent Mars missions, they saw the wreckage of it. So it never was a dark project, and apparently the failure to convert metric and inches correctly was the cause, and it did crash. And so eventually it got discovered. But this one didn't land any place. So, if it didn't work and fell back down into the ocean or burned up, we'll never be able to find the wreckage of it, so to speak. So we may never know. But it's fun to think about it. So, listeners, I guess that's going to be it for Open Lines Tuesday. So let me thank all of you for, calling in tonight and for sending in some of your emails. And we do not have Hotel Mars tomorrow, just to summarize. And we have Mike Gold with us, the attorney, and he hasn't been on the show for a couple of years. He used to be over at Bigelow, and he's real involved with commercial space policy and law. And but he is an attorney, but he works in the business, so he has a different take than the academic attorneys that I've been having on the show for a while. So that'll be on Friday. Mike Gold will be with us. And then we go dark. Don't look for us. You know, you're not going to find us. We're legitimately going off air as I relocate. And hopefully everything gets reconnected properly, and we're back in business in a week. And as I said, I will keep everyone notified vis-a-vis the laptop, because I can get on the laptop with a Verizon key. I can't do the show that way, but I can get on the laptop and keep you notified on the blog if there's going to be any delay. So you'll see messages on upcoming shows if I'm being seriously delayed. So everybody have a great rest of the week. Make sure you listen to Mike Gold on Friday, and keep it safe and keep looking up. So thank everybody again. Good night from the Space Show.